Am I right in saying this is a young men's retreat on the theme of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth? Mm-hmm. Good, good, okay. I'm on the right planet on the right, and on the right day. So I just wanted to say something about, well, all of that really. I thought I'd start off by talking about young. Young is interesting, isn't it? Because we do age. I mean, you may not realise that at your age, especially if you're quite young. You don't think you're going to age. You certainly don't think you're mortal, and you certainly don't think there's going to be an end. You're going to live forever. That does start to wear down in time. But our awareness of our ageing lags behind our experience. And the Buddha's got stuff to say about this in the Pali Canon. Ratnaguna was taking us through a sutta a few weeks back where, you have to sort of reflect on the fact that, you are not above ageing. Ageing is something that's going to happen to you. It's interesting at the moment, isn't it, that we're living in a time when that's almost, the idea of being younger than you actually are is actually something of a virtue. Don't they say something like 50 is the old 30? So you can still do things at 50 that you would have done at 30, like 40 years ago. People want to look young. A friend of mine goes to South America regularly, to Brazil, and he said when he's in Brazilian cities, nobody has got white hair, and he's got a great shock of white hair, and everybody sort of looks at him on the street because he doesn't dye his hair. But it's in South America it's rampant. I mean, you see it in India, you see it over here now. You can look at people who are obviously well over the halfway mark, and they've got this full head of sparkling hair. You think, well, it doesn't quite look right, does it? It looks a bit strange. It is important that we mature physically, emotionally, and psychologically. I remember coming across a mantra by Chogyam Trungpa. He said it was the most important mantra you could ever learn. And it goes, Om, grow up. I thought that was brilliant. What an amazing thing to do. So if you do nothing else in your life, you should at least try to grow up. But that raises all sorts of other questions, doesn't it? And it brings us on to men. What does it mean to be a man? Where are the role models? What is a man like? It's become much more difficult in recent times. You look at people like, Wayne Rooney or, pop stars, and they're doing all sorts of crazy things. If they don't kill themselves in the process, they're doing all sorts of crazy things, and they're men. I mean, they're earning huge amounts of money sometimes, but are they a man? What does it mean to be a man? And I think it's quite useful to sort of try and look at some of the stuff. There's quite a lot of stuff in the movement and on the web, and Robert Bly goes into it, doesn't he, or did do quite a long time ago, and people can think it's old hat, but it's important to know what it is that you're trying to grow into, because that's what's going to happen. You are going to get older, so what are you going to get older and become? And that raises the whole question of the importance of our own sort of family conditioning. I'll mention this again later, but our father is extremely important, or our sort of father figure. It doesn't have to be our biological father. It can be an important father figure. But he teaches us, not by telling us, but just by his example, all that we know about what it is to be a man. Unless we're very on the ball and we can see the faults and see other people, other men who have not got those faults and do a bit of... But that takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of effort. And similarly, mother tells us, or mother figure, tells us all that we know about women. So we need to think about that. Consider what that means. What did our father do? What are the lessons that we've learned from looking at his life? Are they useful? Or are they, unuseful, even destructive? And the same with mother. Because and how did we relate to them both? That's all very important. And you could spend a week in discussion groups, just looking at that stuff. And sometimes we do this on the Spiritual Friendship Going for Refuge retreats. We spend time talking about our relationship with our Father, particularly, and also about our sort of family life, what happened when we were young, how we got on with our siblings, how we related to other young children when we were young children, how we got on at school. All that stuff is extremely important. Very, very important indeed. So in a way, this is all part of the first great stage of the spiritual life, of which spiritual death and spiritual rebirth are the fourth and fifth, depending on which way around you put them. So you're aware about these, aren't you, the five great stages. Integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, sometimes they put that at the end, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. So I'm going to say more about integration, because I think in a way the others come out of integration and are part of integration. In a way, we don't move through these like walking along a path. We do them all at the same time to some extent. Maybe we start more with integration and positive emotion, but the others come up within integration and within positive emotion before we get onto them as definite sort of actual stages. And this reminds me of an analogy that Sangharakshita coined for the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. He said, again, the Noble Eightfold Path isn't a path. You don't do one step, then you do the second step, then the third step. It's like eight strands to a flower, like a stem. So you do all these eight simultaneously, and then when you get to the top, they sort of branch out like sort of petals on an eight-petaled flower. And it's the same with these five, I think. You get these five strands of growth, if you like, these five stages, and they grow up together, and then they blossom. Yeah, when you get to spiritual rebirth, as it were, on its own level. So I think it's useful to sort of to look at them like that. So what else did I want to say next? Spiritual. Let's just look at spiritual, because again, this is a very interesting word, and we tend to sort of drop it all the time. And you see it on adverts. You know, come and do this spiritual workshop. It depends what you mean by spiritual. It's a long time since I've looked spiritual up in the dictionary, but sometimes the dictionary or the sort of the usual usage of a word isn't very helpful to us. But in Buddhism, the word spiritual is very particular, or at least Sangharakshita's version of Buddhism. He's got a very defined set of meanings for this. And he says, I'll quote, this is from an article he wrote in Shabda years ago. I can give you the quote if you want it. Later. The word spiritual, in his own usage, has two meanings, one narrower than the other. In its narrower sense, spiritual corresponds to the Buddhist term kusala, literally skillful, or sometimes translated as wholesomeness, which means characterized by the mental states of freedom from craving, freedom from aversion, and freedom from delusion. You've come across these three, haven't you? The three roots, the three poisons, yeah, as it were. Or, more positively, by contentment, by non-erotic love, and by wisdom. That's how you can translate this word, kusala. Thus, the spiritual life is a life devoted to the cultivation of such states, a spiritual practice, one that conduces to their development, and a spiritual teaching, one which is concerned with them either theoretically or practically or both. In its broader sense, spiritual corresponds, again in Bhante's own usage, not only to the term kusala, but to the still more important term lokutara. These are both Pali terms, I think, which means literally the beyond world, or as we say, the transcendental. That's what lokutara means. When the word spiritual is taken in this broader sense, the spiritual life is one that is devoted not only to the cultivation of skillful mental states, but also to the attainment of the transcendental or nirvana, enlightenment. For Buddhism, it's axiomatic that there is no attainment of the transcendental except on the basis of a mind dominated by the skillful mental states of freedom from craving, freedom from aversion, and freedom from delusion. Or their positive counterparts, contentment, non-erotic love, and wisdom. So that's what spiritual means. So it's not death in an ordinary sense, and it's not death in a sort of airy-fairy kind of way. It's some sort of death that precipitates us into the skillful, or precipitates us into the locutora, yeah, the otherworldly, into the transcendental. And similarly, spiritual rebirth isn't just any sort of rebirth. It's not just feeling a bit better. It's some sort of entry into the skillful or the otherworldly, the transcendental. So we need to bear this in mind, yeah? It's got they're very particular labels. So it's not just sort of death and rebirth in an ordinary kind of sense. And when you put this word spiritual in front of something like spiritual death, I mean, death's quite a big word anyway, so spiritual death sounds sort of sexy, doesn't it? And cool. And, you know, whoa, yeah, spiritual death, man, I'm doing it. If you are, you probably haven't got a smile on your face if you're doing spiritual death. Something else needs to happen. Now then. So in a way, you can see that positive emotion is about this developing, you know, these three positive counterparts to greed, hatred, and delusion. It's all the stuff that you do in the, you know, the metta bhavana, puja, all that kind of thing, friendship, all the sort of stuff that we do in the movement, and sort of we can take for granted in a way. But I don't think you'll find them sort of everywhere. And the, you know, the positive emotion should affect our thoughts and our actions, yeah, and our behaviour, all of that. Right. So you can see probably that we can't really do spiritual death and spiritual rebirth until we've got integration and positive emotion quite well in place. And even then, we have to be extremely receptive, which is why I think sometimes we put spiritual receptivity in the middle before you get to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, as it were. Because you need to sort of listen and look and attend and be aware of what's going on sort of outside. You need to take stuff in. In a way, it's the first part of sort of... spiritual practice is listening, yeah, listening. You need to take a lot in. Then you can reflect on it. Then you can put it into practice. Okay, so that's spiritual, death, young we've done. I did think of calling this talk advice to young men. Because I suppose that's what I'm trying to do is give you some advice, but which is good. But you need to be careful about advice. I mean, ideally, you need to find yourself some sort of mentor as a sort of spiritual acolyte or spiritual apprentice, if you like, or practitioner, young spiritual practitioner. Again, Chogyam Trungpa's very good on this. He said. Words to the effect that we need someone personally concerned with us as an individual, some sort of outside objective reference. And in the movement, we call this sort of Kalyanamitrata, yeah? Some sort of spiritual friend. So again, spiritual friend, yeah? Some sort of friend, some sort of mentor who's going to guide you towards positive mental states and away from the negative. So look for that, yeah? I mean, you know, there are a lot of old boys about in the movement now. Plenty of grey hair. But even then, that doesn't mean anything. I was aware when I first got into the movement, I was in my mid-20s, and it was obvious to me that even in the movement, there were a lot of old fools. Yeah? There's plenty of old fools, you know. So grey hair and being around a long time doesn't necessarily... I mean, you've got any wisdom at all. So you need to be quite tricky about who you pick as some sort of mentor. So just listen to people and see what they say and ponder it, watch what they do, because that's another half of the... It's all very well if they're saying one thing and doing another, then that's a bit dodgy, yeah? Don't necessarily take their advice on trust. I mean, anybody with any sort of wisdom who's lived a bit of time in the spiritual life will be very chary about giving you any sort of advice at all. They won't want to tell you what to do. What they'll try and do is find out what you want to do and then maybe make some sort of comment on it. Like, you know, well, you could do that, but it sounds, you know, very good to me. And maybe they've even got stories about when they did what you'd like to do and it didn't work out very well, yeah? That's much more encouraging than saying, no, I don't think you should do this, you should do that. Okay, it's not a lot of good. So you don't want that sort of advice. So, you know, be careful. And you do get people who, probably even at your ages, yeah, your quite young ages, people who are so full of themselves, they've got loads to say about what you should do. But again, if you watch what they do, you listen to what they say, often there's a mismatch. It doesn't go together. So you have to be quite careful with that. And it goes with this business of sort of mentorship, yeah, and Kalyana Mitrata, friendship, the whole sort of business. You want friends and mentors who are going to sort of lead you to the skillful and lead you to the transcendental in the long run, hopefully. Right. Da-da-da-da-da. Integration. Back to integration again. We need to know what we're like. Yeah, that's the whole point of integration. Integration is like coming together. It's finding out what all the bits of yourself are like when you put them all together and how that operates. Yeah, knowing what you're like for others. It's very important. It's all very well knowing what you're like for yourself, but how do other people see you? And again, this objective reference outside yourself, somebody, even a peer, well, especially a peer, who can tell you honestly what you're really like without sort of beating you down, but in a helpful kind of way, that's amazing. That's exactly what you need. You need to know what you're like psychologically, emotionally, and ethically. Yeah, one of the big parts of integration is becoming ethical. Because our actions have consequences. And in Buddhism, actions are of body, of speech, and of mind. So we do physical actions. The things that we say have consequences. And even the things that we think have consequences. Even if we don't act them out or speak them, they still have consequences for us inside. They can sort of break us up or they can integrate us. So it depends on what we're thinking. We need to be very, very aware. And that's why mindfulness and... awareness is so important in the stage of integration. This business of actions having consequences, we need to be able to see that. We need to watch our own actions and see what the consequences of those are. I mean, probably, you know, I mean, by the time you're 25, you've done all sorts of things and had all sorts of consequences. You've got plenty to reflect on. So spend time doing that. Think about what your life has been like and how you've operated and whether it's been any use or not, yeah? Whether it's been, you know, helpful or unhelpful, whether it's been pleasant or painful, not that they're necessarily a good sort of evaluation. I'll say more about that later. So these four dimensions of awareness, I suppose you're aware of these, are you? You've come across these, the four dimensions of awareness, Banti's four. Awareness of self, so that's body, feelings and thoughts, awareness of others, awareness of nature, so that includes the environment, stuff around you, yeah, and then awareness of reality, which you could say is, you could gloss as sort of how things actually are. And probably, again, part of the reason you're here is because you're aware of the fact that, okay, there's all this information out there, we're in this sort of information boom at the moment, aren't we? Well, all over the world, it's not just the West. There's this information boom, but are we really in tune with the way things actually are? There's all this information, but it doesn't necessarily address correctly and usefully how things actually are. And if you look at your own experience, you'll probably find there's a mismatch between what all the information tells you and how things actually are, yeah, even in your own experience. There we do. No, not too bad. Good, okay. What else did I want to say? So, spiritual death. Where's death? Now, I could bang on about, you know, no self and all that kind of stuff, but I'm a rather practical sort of person, always have been, and before I could get onto that stuff, I mean, I'm getting to it now, but it's taken a long time. I like to get my feet on the ground and, okay, what do I do? What do I feel? What do I experience? So with spiritual death, you can ask yourself, okay, what's the experience? What does spiritual death actually feel like? And it strikes me, I mean, having worked on the ordination team for 20 odd years, you know, banging on about going for refuge until it sort of, you know, soaked me. You know what going for refuge is, do you? Have you come across this term? Yeah? If not, ask your group leader and get him to explain what going for refuge is. Spiritual death, the experience of spiritual death, is very similar to the experience of going for refuge. And I've given this quite a lot of thought over the years. It strikes me that the experience of going for refuge, when you really go, yeah, and the experience of spiritual death is a whole range of things. It can be unpleasant, painful, humiliating, embarrassing, frightening, upsetting. It'll be emotionally intense. There'll probably be a rush of adrenaline. And or it can be, even at the same time, exhilarating, inspiring, joyful. You may end up feeling much more confident, much more alive, more potent, and more open. It's interesting, I was looking at Carmela Sheila. I don't know if you've come across Carmela Sheila. He's one of the meditation experts in the movement, lived at Vajraloka, our meditation centre, for many, many years. And he's just rewritten his book on meditation, called, now it's called Buddhist Meditation. But in there, he describes spiritual death as the collapse of delusion, which I think is a brilliant way of putting it. There's a collapse of delusion. You've got this delusion. You think things are the way you think they are. And then suddenly that all collapses. Something that you're leaning on breaks. Yeah, it's kicked away. These could be delusions about who you are, who others are, what's going on around you, what life is all about. If you can get over the shock of the collapse of delusion, and I think it's the same with going for refuge, there's a collapse of delusion, and you're looking for something else, something you can really hold on to that's actually going to help you to float in a positive sense. If you can get over this shock, then there's an increased and expanded awareness, and you can learn to enjoy the experience. It's very, very exhilarating if you can bear it. You may have to bear quite a lot of unpleasantness to begin with. That's why I said, you know, pleasure and pain aren't necessarily good indicators of whether something's leading you in the skillful or the unskillful direction. Not everything that's painful is bad and unskillful. Not everything that's pleasurable is skillful and good. Yeah. So you have to, there's plenty to reflect on. For me, this experience has always come about primarily in the state of reaction. Reaction has always been the first part of my experience. So whenever you find yourself having a reaction or getting upset and angry, ask yourself, now why is this so upsetting? What is it about this? What's really going on here? The reactivity, I think, is the surface of a self-clinging and a closed mind, yeah? Put your nose in it, whatever that experience is, put your nose in it, however unpleasant, and don't allow yourself any deviation. A little axiom that I really like from Pema Chodron is, whatever arises is the path. So if you have a reaction, that's the path. You dig into that and find out what's going on, because it's a really useful clue to integration. Yeah, you can get a lot out of that. It's a sure sign that one of your treasured little props against reality, a treasured little opinion, a treasured little view or self-image has been kicked out of place. And then you get this collapse and this sense of falling, which can be, as I said, unpleasant, painful, humiliating, embarrassing, whatever it is, frightening, and incredibly sort of, yes, alive. You can feel really alive when you get in that sort of condition. So watch out for reactions. They're brilliant. They're an opportunity. Use them as an opportunity. This brings me on to, again, it's about pleasure and pain, I suppose. We tend to be ruled by, if not completely defined, by our likes and dislikes. But likes and dislikes are all conditioned. They're produced by previous causes or networks of causes. They come from past experiences and past actions, and none of them are absolute. They are habits worn deeply into the ruts of our being till they become our identity. Likes and dislikes begin instinctively and are closely connected to, even the forerunners of, greed and hatred. So we need to look at them quite closely. Yeah, the things that we like and the things that we don't like. If we're liking and disliking things on an instinctual basis, probably underneath them there's greed and there's hatred. And we'll fall into those as quickly as anything. You know what mental states are like. You like something and then suddenly you want as much of it until it makes you sick. Yeah. And if there's something you don't like, you want to get as far away from it or whoever it is as possible. Without any thinking, it's just instinctual. You throw it away, you get away from it. So you need to watch that because we can make a lot of mistakes by acting so instinctively. When we are experiencing greed and hatred, we're believing the deluded stories we tell ourselves about what's actually going on. We need to replace likes and dislikes, greed and hatred, with right view and with Dharmic principles. So again, there's a lot to learn because the Buddha was full of all sorts of stuff about how things actually are, and particularly about how to deal with greed and hatred, your likes and your dislikes. Okay, that was that bit. Done that. Yeah. Getting on quite well. Good. I wanted to say something about altruism because what's his name over there? My mind's gone. Was telling me, oh, he said we were doing yoga together yesterday. He said, oh, one of the things we haven't talked about is altruism. One of the things about Buddhism is that. In a way, you're not doing this for yourself. And the sooner you can get away from any idea that you're doing this for yourself, the better it is. One of the big factors of reality is this business of self and other. Yeah, it's the big sort of dichotomy. You know, do you help yourself or do you help others? And Bhante's very keen on the idea that, people often say, well, shouldn't I get myself together first? Shouldn't I help myself first? He said, well, no, you can just as well help other people. Forget about yourself. Get that out of the way and just get on with helping other people. Sometimes we're so preoccupied with self that we end up nitpicking. So we're so in turn that people are just sort of cardboard cutouts outside that we bump into or ride roughshod or all over the place. And we're doing a lot of damage to ourselves and to them. Because that all has to be sort of caught up with in the long run. So altruism is a very big part of Buddhism. You can't do this alone. None of us can do this alone. You know, I mean, we've got this big movement now. People tend to think that it's been here forever. But it's been hard won through, people like me, who are young men, thrown together in a heap, tearing each other to bits and pulling off bloody lumps of each other out of competitiveness and all the rest of it. You don't have to do that. That's the other good thing about the old and mentors, is you can learn from their mistakes. And if they've got any wisdom at all, they should be able to tell you what they did wrong that you don't have to do. You can learn by other people's mistakes. You don't have to make mistakes yourself. On the other hand, it's okay to make mistakes. In a way, if you don't make mistakes or recognise mistakes in other people, you won't learn anything. So it is important to address mistakes. Mistakes, in a way, are quite good. But you don't have to do them yourself. You can do them for other people, through other people, as it were. Oh, there was another point there about that. That's gone. Okay. That's gone. So I'm not going to say very much about... I'm not going to say anything about spiritual rebirth. That's it. One other point that I wanted to make was... I'm quite a physical person, so I read books. I read books on physical exercise, like other people would read novels. And I came across a book the other day. It was a sort of by a Russian kettlebell stuff. It was this exercise, and at the back of the book, the guy says he gives these. Can I trade this for that in your system? He said, well, as soon as you've asked that question, you've made a mistake. This is a system. A system is a self-contained situation by definition. So you can't mess about with it. You can't take the bits you like and the bits you don't like. You're back in likes and dislikes again, aren't you? So you have to take a system as it is, as a whole. It's closed, yeah? And you need to honour that, at least until you've exhausted its possibilities. And I thought, God, that's a really good point. And it's the same in the spiritual life. People say they like the meditation, but they don't like the puja. You know, they like Dharma study, but they don't like being with other people and like talking to them and sharing themselves and all that sort of thing. You won't get anywhere like that. You have to take the whole thing. Yeah, particularly I think Buddhism as a whole and particularly Banti's sort of system. You have to take the whole thing and do the whole thing. You can, Banti's so liberal sometimes. He says, well, okay, if something doesn't seem to work, put it to one side. Don't throw it in the bin, put it to one side and just remember it's there, because you may find it comes up later and then you can use it. You may just not be ready for it yet, but don't throw it away. But in the long run, I think everything in the system has to be addressed, yeah? Do the system until you've proved that it's wrong or limited. Good. So in this respect, one of the big things that that people get into sometimes is that they like meditation, but they don't want the rest of Buddhism. Meditation is not the whole of the spiritual life. And if you just do meditation and ignore everything else, it's not going to work. Because meditation is based on particularly ethical practice. And you do ethics with other people. It's about your behaviour with others. That's the basis of ethics. So if you're trying to do meditation without any addressing of other people, you're going to get in a mess. Meditation won't work. And usually in the traditional manuals, if something's wrong in meditation, the meditation teacher will say to you, okay, what are your ethics like? It's the first thing they go to. Not to the practice itself, but what's the underpinning of it? How do you actually behave? How do you treat other people? How do you treat yourself? Yeah, all that needs to be borne in mind. That underpins your meditation practice. So in a way, with the spiritual life, the context is reality. It's everything. You can't leave anything out. Oh, that reminds me. That's it. The other little bit was... sex. I thought I'd better say something about sex. Yeah. When I was in my 20s, I thought it was the meaning of life, but I wasn't getting it, which was extremely painful. It's not a problem now so much. Sex is chemical, gentlemen. It's testosterone in your bloodstream, and sooner or later it starts to run down. So don't get too cranked about it. Don't worry if you're not getting it. Maybe you're, one of those happy 2% of the population. They've been making a lot of this in the press recently that are asexual. Yeah, they're just not interested in sex. I wish I'd been like that. I wouldn't have wasted quite so much time. It does get better as you get older. Yeah, you don't have to. It doesn't take as much of your energy unless you become obsessed with it. So beware creating a rut, a really deep rut, where you're so obsessed with it that you can't put it down even in your 60s and 70s, yeah? Because, I mean, again, maybe you've seen this in your own experience. I don't know. You see this sort of thing at Butterfield, don't you, and on mixed retreats. You see some old boy who's like, you know, well over the hill, and he's hanging around with all the girls, and you think, ooh, God, there's something degrading about that. It's extremely ignoble, yeah? Or he's hanging around with all the young boys. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter which way the testosterone takes you. You just have to be careful that you don't turn it into a deep habit. Remember, in Buddhism, what you dwell on, you become. So if you spend all your time thinking about sex, thinking in a particular way, I'll say a bit more of this in a minute. If you spend all your time thinking about it, you'll just become this sort of... animal, basically. You'll become some sort of animal. Oh, no, I don't remember that animal. No, there's a reason. There's a reason for animal. Banti's very good on sex. And I think maybe it's because he's done a bit of it, which you probably heard about. I know it makes him, extremely, what is the word, I can't think of the word... slightly sort of questionable in controversial, that's it. He makes him a very controversial figure, but I think it gives him an edge over a lot of other people. One of the early axioms that I heard from Banti, which I found very useful, was with regard to sex, don't think about it when it isn't there. Enjoy it when it is there, and don't think about it when it's gone. Now, I think here, think means like dwelling upon, fantasizing about, rerunning that little episode in the corridor with whoever it was. You know what I mean? Until you know, that's all you can think about. Not that sort of thinking. It does need to be reflected on. That's it. This is where the animal comes in. This is Banti again. Don't propagate your genes. Propagate your ideals. Any fool can propagate their genes. Yeah, you can do that in a completely drunken state. Animals do it all the time. They are not self-aware and self-reflective. Do you want to be an animal or do you want to be an angel? You can ask yourself that sort of question. Yeah, do you want to propagate your ideals or propagate your genes? It's easy to do genes. Not that I'm saying that that's a bad thing to do or a wrong thing to do. Maybe for you that's what you need to do. Talk about it with your friends. But remember that the whole business of sex is an ethical issue. It's a big ethical issue. It usually involves another human being. And you have the capability to damage them or enhance them, yeah, by the way that you deal with what you're doing with them. So that you really need to bear that in mind. Another thing Banti once said was... which I didn't find particularly useful. He said, well, you know, why does it have to be another person? You know, just be sexual with yourself. I tried that, but I didn't find it much use because I took myself everywhere, including on retreat, and it sort of got in the way. So I gave that up. But sex does need to be addressed and it needs to be thought about because it's a powerful passion. It's easy to make very big ethical mistakes. And actions do have consequences. So if you're heterosexual, you can end up with a lot of responsibility, which really you ought to address and carry. Or you can end up, whichever way you go, you can end up with diseases, can't you? And people aren't honest. They're not honest with each other about what's going on in their little biological bodies. And sometimes they'll tell you they're clean when they're not. And... you don't know. You have to know someone quite well, I think, before you're prepared to mix your juices, so to speak. anything I've forgotten? I think one of the big things about this business of integration is taking responsibility. And I think it's part of becoming mature, it's part of growing up, and it's part of being a man, is that you need to be able to acknowledge your behaviour and take responsibility for it. And young people don't often do that. That's why I said I was talking about the role models, wasn't I? You get these, you know, highly paid, you know, football players who do all sorts of silly things, and then the next day it's like they're on the front page, and they're sort of going, "Oh, why did, I don't know why I did that," kind of thing. Thoughtless behaviour. Yeah, you've got to be able to take responsibility for what you've done, and I think that goes right across the board, and it even includes things like. Watch yourself very closely if you find yourself blaming others, because blame is passing responsibility onto others. I mean, I think you can take too much responsibility sometimes, but that's another issue. But take care that you don't blame somebody else for what you could do something about. So, I mean, the big one here is, like, for instance, I mentioned how sort of fundamental our mother and father were in our lives. It's a waste of time spending half your life moaning about the fact that your parents didn't do X, Y, and Z for you. Okay, you know what they didn't do for you. Go out and do something about it. Don't blame them. Poor devils, they did the best they could. I don't know, there's something about history, isn't there? That I think two world wars meant that a couple of generations didn't get proper mentoring from their parents. Yeah, and you can't blame them for that. It's a sort of, the insurance people call it act of God, don't they? It's just something that happens out of ordinary people's control. So you can't blame them for that. They did the best they could. You're here, for heaven's sake, you know? This is a positive place to be. That's probably got something to do with your parents, if they were difficult. Mine weren't that easy, but, I've learnt to sort of forgive them and love them. And again, I think that's part of positive emotion, forgiving and... Gratitude for what they did give me, actually. I think in many respects, if it wasn't for my dear old dad, again, I wouldn't be... Well, and my mum, actually, because my mum was so volatile and unpredictable that she taught me a healthy respect for women. Women were dangerous. They were dangerous, unpredictable, and they could lash you with their tongues. So it's like... Ooh. It still didn't stop me getting into a lot of trouble, as I mentioned earlier. So I think that's about all I've got to say, really. I hope it's been of some use, and probably it's given your group leaders plenty to run past you when you get in your groups.